Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hi everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name's John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Chris Yogerst, who is the author of a new book, The Warner Brothers, a biography of probably the most important family in Hollywood, certainly in the creation of Hollywood, from the silence on all through to the present day. If you enjoy the conversation, please remember to leave a review if you can. But before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation. So obviously you're writing this book in the centenary of the studio. I've interviewed quite a few people in the last year or two. Sam Wasson doing the with Janine Basinger, this sort of classical. We're going to go back to the beginning of everything. And I found your book. It gave me a really good overview of sort of the beginning of Hollywood and how connected everything is.
Oh, it's incredible. And I'm glad you mentioned Sam, because I just did a talk at Book Soup in LA that he hosted for me. And, he's fantastic. And he's, equally as interested in, every layer of the entire history of it. And the centennial thing, that was kind of a happy accident. I mean, the book took longer, or I shouldn't say took longer, but it was like, I've wanted this book to be a biography of Harry Warner, because I kind of wanted to make him more center. And then Pat McGilligan said, you got to do all of the Warner Brothers, because not everyone knows who Harry Warner is. And he's right. But yeah, what's interesting about the Warners, like you said, everything is so connected that by 1923, when they incorporate as Warner Bros, they are old pros, right? Like they ran theaters, they ran distribution chains, they'd been shut down by Edison and they started up again. Like they had been through it, man. They made movies and had successes and flops. So, and even then, even the pre, we think of, Hollywood's golden age is kind of starting in the 20s. A lot of the silent film purists will go before that, which I won't argue with either. But yeah, how connected everything was by like 1912, right? Like all these people, everyone knew who everyone was, Lemley and Fox and the Warners and Lasky. They all knew everybody already. And, you know, you would have thought that 10 years from then, it was going to be this booming industry that was going to be leading the world for generations.
Yeah, that's what's crazy, is because we're watching it, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, and we're seeing these guys on the ground floor of this amazing industry. But there's absolutely no evidence at the time that that is going to happen. I mean, they're just, they're on the next fad. I mean, they're selling sort of Nickelodeon style events that aren't even films at a certain point.
Well, yeah. Well, and with Warners, they were entrepreneurs. It was just in their blood, this just desire to get ahead and not go back to where they came from. And yeah, I'm glad you said fad. That's a perfect word, because they ran bicycle shops, they ran bowling alleys, grocery stores, butcher shops. I mean, they tried it, and they're like, oh, this is the next thing. This is the next thing. So they were, but I think that what that speaks to is the type of movies they ended up greenlighting, you know, decades later, because they always tried to have their finger on the pulse of the culture, right? And that's exactly what their movies were doing. So they were doing essentially the same thing, you know, by jumping on the bicycle fad, doing it just slightly too late. But it was really no different than like, hey, what's in the headlines? What are people talking about? Let's make a movie about that and engage in our culture. So they're just doing it on a bigger scale, right? But it's the same mentality that drove them to success in Hollywood that they were doing very small time in Ohio and Philly.
Yeah, well, let's go back even further than that, because they're really influenced by their family and about the fact that they're coming from Europe. Where are they from, and what sort of what is the old country background that they're coming out of?
So it's what is now Poland, and the word the city that they're from, I always hesitate to try to pronounce it. I got to figure out who knows how to pronounce it, so I'm not going to embarrass myself. But it starts with a K. But yeah, that's where Ben and Pearl, you know, are living there, and they are, I mean, it's very much, I mean, it, from what was described to by the family or to the family from people who could remember, it sounds a lot like what we hear about 1937, 38, 39 in Poland, where you're living in fear, you're practicing your faith in secret. And I mean, it is just not safe. So they decide to get out. And it's the, you know, kind of a similar story to a lot of people, where one of Ben's friends goes to New York and writes him, it's like, oh, everything is better here. So Ben goes, of course, not everything is better. I mean, probably better than it was where they were. They could, you know, practice their faith without fear of being murdered. But it's still, you know, poverty, getting work is tricky. And, you know, it's a kind of story where you make enough money, you send for some of your family, you make a little bit more money. Eventually you get everybody here. And then it was a slow burn to, you know, I know there's the famous story of the shoe repair shop that Harry is the oldest was working with him on. But I mean, he had all kinds of jobs. You know, he was a fur trader for a while. So all over the place, you know, they ran the grocery store, like I said, but they were very, very determined. So the parents, really, that influence came through to the entire family, top to bottom. But also one of the things that really solidified the family that came from both parents was this like all for one and one for all mentality. And right. And that's why the family was so close. Of course, Jack was always kind of the outlier in this, but they really taught the family that if they stuck together, regardless of if you're in the middle of a big success or a big failure, that you will be okay. And it was this was kind of a leveling, you know, it was a way to teach them, you know, I guess kind of this, I guess what's the best way to put it? I mean, it was a way to weather whatever storm, and, you know, coming from where what they did and everything they did, not only growing up overseas, but then also weathering what they did here in the States, that they taught their kids that you can pretty much prevail through anything. And this primed them for all of this national and internationally followed battles that they would, you know, they would be a part of throughout their career in Hollywood.
Is this what appeals to you as the Warners as a story, as opposed to any other studio? Is this the thing that gets you? Because I mean, even when they're selling shoes, as you were saying, they don't just sell shoes, they repair shoes as you wait. I mean, that's a promise, that's a branding, yep, that sort of runs all the way through.
Oh, their branding. Yeah, they were brilliant with branding constantly. And you know, that's why I love The Repaired While You Wait, which, you know, surprised, you know, this banker, and then that, you know, got them a foot in the door to get some support later down the road. But yeah, I've always been interested in the Warner Brothers because they're so different. I mean, they're in a lot of ways, they're the same as a lot of the studio moguls, right? A lot of these guys have the similar immigrant story. They were fleeing from their families or fleeing from something. They came here for promises of a better future. So that tracks with almost all of them, probably all of them. But yeah, with the Warner Brothers, it's that branding and setting themselves apart from everyone else in town, whether it was from other shoe shops or other movie studios, they were doing that same thing. And they're always trying to find their niche, right? Like, what makes us different? And they did that. I mean, yeah, that's what's so cool about learning about these early businesses. There's so many things that are actually similar to the Hollywood studio decades later.
So they start in film, as we sort of hinted at earlier, kind of with Nicol, right at the very beginning, and with silent films, and even prior to that with sort of these events, you know, almost like sideshows, I guess. And then when they move out to California, it's kind of fleeing Edison and his guys, his thugs, really.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they were, you know, they had the Duquesne film distribution company that got shut down by Edison. But yeah, a lot of people were going out to LA just because it was harder for Edison's attack dogs to keep an eye on them. And yeah, by the late teens, they were in LA. They had a lot that they built or that they bought or renting for a little while, not far from the Selig Zoo. So the Selig Zoo is famous because that's where the MGM lion was. And, you know, the Warner Brothers did an early serial called The Lost World, I believe, if I remember correctly. I got a picture in my book of it, and they used some of the zoo's animals in that and things like that. So yeah, they wanted to be somewhere. I mean, and not like, you know, a lot of the other studios were doing the same thing. Like, where can we go and actually grow? Because that was the problem. They could only get so big before they would get pushback from Edison's trust, right? And of course, by the late teens, the trust was gone, but some of those threats were still there. Edison was still around. His company was still around. So you've got, you know, how can we, I get the sense that a lot of the mentality with a lot of these founding figures was like, where can we go and get big enough that if anybody else comes after us, you know, we actually have some weight to throw around. You know, we'll have a studio, we'll have maybe a theater chain, you know, we're going to have some successes under our belt, our name will grab headlines, you know, favorable headlines, like that kind of stuff. So they certainly did. And from like 1918 to 23 was a really pivotal time where they again, ripping from the headlines, you know, they did My 4 Years in Germany, where they licensed this book. So they're also early on that trend too. Like, how can we license something that was popular, already built an audience? And they make that, you know, during World War One, right? So they're, you know, this is something that's, you know, in the headlines on, you know, people are discussing over coffee. So let's make a movie about that. So they're doing that. They're also expanding during this time. They buy the lot in Hollywood, the Bronson Studios, and they start expanding that. So that is a big period of growth, the late teens, early 20s. And of course, they incorporated in 1923, which is, you know, why the centennial is this year. But they did a lot leading up to that. So by the time they incorporated, they were very practiced in every part of the business.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that idea of a Warner Brothers film begins to form at this point, and that, you know, as you say, grabbed from the, you know, ripped from the headlines story. And so at this point, what is the division of labor between the brothers? Who's doing what, and who's got the most power, or is it more, how's the fratriarchy? That's not a word, but
we'll allow it. It's really, I mean, from the beginning, I mean, it's Harry and Albert are the older ones, so they're the ones from the beginning that, I mean, even as early as 1905, they are the ones who are managing the money, they're getting the loans, they're the business, kind of the business end of this. And Sam, like, you know, their first theater, Sam was running the projector and doing a lot of the technical stuff, and Jack was pretty young yet, maybe taking tickets. And, you know, Jack tells stories of singing in his horrible voice so that you could clear people out in between showings. But by the teens, Jack and Sam were the ones that were you know, they, even before that, they were the ones who jumped from when they had a distribution office in Pittsburgh, they went to Norfolk to open another one. Once we get past that, Harry and Albert are in New York running offices, and Jack and Sam are off either making films or distributing films in other cities. And by the time we get to LA, Albert and Harry are still in New York. And this is where we see the origins of what ends up becoming the norm in Hollywood, right? Where the studio bosses are in LA and the you know, the parent companies and the studio presidents are in New York City.
Right.
So Jack and Sam is in LA. Jack spends a little bit of time in San Francisco. But when they get when they start getting property in LA, it's really Jack and Sam that are producing movies. Jack likes to say that he was directing some of them, may or may not. I mean, they were early on, but it was really the division of labor was pretty much the production side, hands-on kind of stuff was Jack and Sam. And then all of the higher end distribution, money management, loan management, all of that was Harry and Albert.
And how does it divide then in terms of who's getting how they're distributing the money? I mean, is that equitable, or is the I'm going to have more salary because I got more responsibility, or how's that working out in the
That's a really good question that I don't have a good answer for, unfortunately. I'm guessing it was more or less equitable just because I didn't see any battles over that,
right,
you know, because
right.
there probably would have been. But I, you know, I get this, especially then. I mean, you were talking, you know, 1920s. I mean, regardless of what they were making or if it was different, it was way more than everybody else in the country.
This is becoming one of the biggest studios at this point. This is a sort of one of the reigning studios. And of course, and this is where it goes back to perhaps one of my first questions, which is how everything's connected. No sooner these movies started, no sooner is the growth there, than they face this huge challenge of, wait a minute, are we going to transition into sound? Is that technically even possible? How is it going to work with the cinemas and the technology?
Yeah, this was tricky, right? And there's all the story. And that's one of the things I want to do in this book, too. I wanted to expand on Sam's story and who he was behind, you know, what, you know, we didn't just, you know, it wasn't just like, hey, let's buy Vitagraph. And then the Jazz Singer comes out a year later. Like, this was a long process. And he really, truly worked himself to death to bring this technology to market. But it's also important to remember that everybody was almost the entire industry did not want sound movies. And even Thomas Edison, once he realized that the Warners were getting close to bringing this to market, he was in the press talking trash about the Warners. I mean, he didn't. And of course, he was by this time, he's the famous inventor, Thomas Edison. And he's, you know, like, well, I couldn't make it work. So it's a fool's errand to even try to do it. So there's a little arrogance there. But This goes back to Sam again, right? He was the one who got the projector to get them to open their first theater in 1905. So here he is again with the next technology that he worked tirelessly with some engineers at Western Electric and both in LA, and then they bought Vitagraph in Brooklyn. And so he's in Brooklyn and he's in New York City renting out spaces, trying to find the best ways to get this really clunky technology to work. I mean, we got to remember, this was not, you know, it was William Fox actually had it right, but he had his own personal problems that were this slid back. But the sound on film technology is what took over. This was the sound on disc, where you've got to like start the projector and a wax record at the same time to make sure it's synced up. And if you've, you know, somebody bumps it, or sneezes and they're too close to the record, all of a sudden it's off. So I can't imagine what a nightmare this was to work on. But it was something that Sam could get and amplify. That was another big part of it. You got to remember, I mean, these you know, speakers were not that great. So luckily you had a lot of these old movie houses and theaters that were constructed in a way that the sound would carry, you know, they got stages. So there used to be people just talking in plays, and that sound would carry to the back. So you got to find the right places to put these speakers with whatever power you can get out of them, so people in the back can hear. Another thing you had pushing against was, you know, silent movies were easy to sell internationally because you just change out the title or the intertitles, right? And you, whatever language, that's easier. If you record the entire thing in English, now you're stuck with English. And if you want to, you know, redub it, that's a whole nother process. You know, that's another, you know, really expensive to do, which of course they did eventually. But there was, it's an interesting story just because there were so many kind of cultural and economic layers pushing back against this technology actually becoming the norm. And here was Sam thinking like, no, we can do it. We can make this really awesome. And he did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking of the comedians, of course, like Chaplin, you know, resisting and resisting and resisting. And I think rightly resisting because, you know, when he brings out as great a film as The Great Dictator is, his voice is just awful. I just can't stand his voice. It's just like, it's sort of like, you know, when he does that big speech at the end, he just sounds like a little pipsqueak. And it's just like, it's so uncharismatic. Whereas Laurel and Hardy, you know, yes, they have to, they're beloved in Italy, for instance, because Alberto Sordi dubs Oliver Hardy. And so it adds to the personality.
Right. Yeah. It's the sound, the transition is interesting. Well, that's one of the other things I learned just as an aside that was really fascinating because, of course, Warner Brothers, like everyone else, they were starting to build stars, right? And you're investing. And, of course, they had Rin Tin Tin, but they also had Monty Blue, who we don't really remember much today because he was in silent movies and was big and then was gone. And Monty Blue is one of these people that Jack kept on the payroll. You know, anybody that didn't really make that transition to the new industry in the 30s, he kept on the payroll, which is something that's, you know, for Jack and all of his faults, which are many. He was, you know, it was one of the things I learned in this book is that he was good to a lot of people, just not his family. So, right. You know, we have all these and some of his stars. But there was, every now and again, these kind of stories would pop out where he was like surprisingly good to people. And this was, and that was one of them. Yeah. The silent stars. He really, you know, the people that helped build the studio really helped them out after that.
And when you're coming into the 20s and 30s and you're coming into the sound period proper, their choice of stars seemed to be a lot of those people who you would look at today and they would be the exemplars of what we think of as golden Hollywood. You know, Humphrey Bogart, Edward G. Robinson, Betty Davis, you know, all those wonderful faces and names.
Oh yeah, they did a really good job building celebrity around the type of movies they like to make, right? And, you know, so, of course, their movies, they're ripped from the headlines, the gritty kind of salt of the earth type movies, right? During the Depression, they're making movies about the Depression, not escapist movies about, you know, a better world. So they develop very similar stars, right? You mentioned Robinson and Cagney, right? We've got these city boys, right? To quote Robert Sklar, that really mesh with the type of brash movie that they like to make, but then also similar, Betty Davis and Olivia de Havilland, right? You've got these aren't the kinds of women you see at other studios, right? Like these aren't just pretty faces, right? You don't want to mess with these women, right? They will take you down. And Warner Brothers did a really good job also cultivating. I mean, one of my favorite stars of the 30s is Joan Blondell, right? I mean, she's like a lot of people, we talk about Betty Davis a lot, but it's like, man, Joan Blondell was every bit a badass as Betty Davis. I think Betty Davis, you know, she was just better at going, you know, pushing back against her bosses than Joan Blondell was. But on screen, for my money, it's hard to beat Joan Blondell in the early 30s. And yeah, it was top to bottom, big stars, little stars, supporting stars, you know, supporting talent. I mean, there's like, you know, at the second if you turn on TCM in the middle of a movie and you don't know it, you'll be able to know if it's a Warner Brothers movie just by the types of characters that are on the screen. And I feel like that influence was very much top down. I mean, the kinds of movies that got greenlit, the kind of attitudes that the brothers had, you know, they were very public. Harry was very public, giving a lot of speeches, gave a lot of talks on the lot for his employees. So I feel like that attitude was cultivated from the top and really taken care of. I mean, throughout, you know, so as long as the Warner Brothers were running the studio, it was very much kind of the tough, gritty studio that we love.
And it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of the, there's a sort of paternalism as well, in the sense that, that every year he gives this sort of Christmas address or end of year address to everyone, as all like, okay, in the family, this is what we're all about, and we're all about bringing peace and communicating and all this stuff, until the war happens, and then it's like, now we're all about getting ready to go to war.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's what, that was part of their genius, though. They were really good at reading the social and political winds. And they knew, and this is why they, you're right, they were so ahead of everyone on the Nazi front. And that's why the Office of War Information had a lot of faith in Warner Brothers right after Pearl Harbor, because they were the ones who were pushing against the Nazis already before it was, they were technically able to do it because of the production code.
I watched I Was a Nazi Spy, or is it Confessions of a Nazi Spy?
Confessions of a Nazi Spy, yeah.
I watched that as in preparation for the interview, because I'd never seen it. And reading your book, I was just like, this is one film that I can't not watch for talking to Chris, especially after reading your earlier book as well about, you know, Hollywood versus Hitler. What a great film. I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's obviously propaganda. It's obviously,
It's because it feels like a documentary in parts.
And the speeches to the jury / audience. But I love the way Edward G. Robinson puts on his most British accent. It's sort of like the least, I mean, I don't know how to say this, sort of, to use a euphemism of the time, the least ethnic he can possibly be, as a, you know, as a sort of way of saying, look, I'm not speaking like an interested party here. I'm speaking like almost like James Mason or someone.
Oh, for sure. Right. And we know just from the archive documents that Edward G. Robinson wanted to do this movie as a Jew. Like he wanted, you know, this was a personal interest to him. But and I'm glad you enjoyed it, because this is a movie I've shown it in class too, and you know, students have really surprisingly enjoyed it. I give them a lot of this background and production, and I give them a sense of what 1938-39 was like. And then, you know, that was 2 years ago. Last year, I did the same thing with Immortal Storm, the MGM film. You know, they also enjoyed it. But it's, yeah, a lot of these movies. And this is a great example, because that's what also draws me to Warner Brothers, because they're doing this with so many of their movies, where they are really, really engaged in what's going on in the world. Right. Like, this was based on a real story. I mean, Jack Warner sent screenwriters to follow the Leon Theroux trial to understand this better and get some quotes and all of that and make it into a movie. And I also always, I've been pushing a lot for, you know, if there's a 30s film that people haven't seen that I want them to see more of, Confessions of a Nazi Spy is great. I mean, you're right. It's pretty clear propaganda, but like a great film that has aged really, really well is Black Legion with Humphrey Bogart.
Oh yeah. That's it's one of my favorite Humphrey Bogart, sort of little known Humphrey Bogart films.
Right. That's packed such a punch today. And that's, you know, that was 37. So that lead, you know, that's a precursor to Confession of a Nazi Spy. But yeah, Warner Brothers has all these movies lining up to that. And then Nazi Spy, you know, once again, they're leading the industry. And now other studios start making anti-Nazi movies, because technically you couldn't do that because of the production code, right? You couldn't ridicule other nations. So this was tricky, but Warner Brothers said, screw it, we're going to do it. And then, of course, we get Mortal Storm and Great Dictator, right? We get Chaplin, you know, we get everyone else realizes, maybe we can get away with this.
Yeah. And I mean, the interesting thing is as well that you see them defining America in a way that it hasn't really been defined before, because they're defining America as a place of equality, of the minorities are protected, of, you know, religious observance is protected, and all these things are, you know, it's kind of open to debate whether you could truly define America in those terms prior. You've got it kind of, the Nazis are, in a way, are a good enemy to go against in this sense, because it makes the good stuff really good.
Oh, right. Well, and the thing to remember here, and we talked about this last time I was on with my previous book, you know, when we look back now, it's easy to, you know, the Nazis are such like a stereotypical, like easy enemy. But in 1939, the country, you know, the United States was really divided on whether or not to even step in to go against the Nazis. So, you know, and that's why the U.S. Senate went after Hollywood.
Fast forward to today when even as we speak, I think that Congress is forwarding a bill which has withdrawn help to Ukraine.
Oh, right, right. And that's why I keep mentioning, I'm like, you couldn't have a better parallel to like Poland 1939 than Ukraine right now. I don't know how people don't understand that. I mean, it's plain as day. But right, there's a similar kind of, you know, it'll probably be another thing. We look back on history and people I'll have to explain to my daughter, like, yeah, people were divided on this. And it was the same thing, right? There was the isolationists and interventionists, and there was a lot of, you know, and a lot of people were rightfully kind of frustrated about a lot of things that happened after World War One. So there was some of these people that were understandably hesitant, but there were other people who were hesitant because they were sympathetic to the Nazis, which was a whole other thing, including a lot of the, you know, U.S. senators. So, yeah, Warner Brothers was pushing against that. And that's one of the things that Harry was, like you said, yeah, he was giving, he would give in the Warner Club News, he would write these little speeches and he would talk about this. I mean, it wasn't just, it wasn't phony. I mean, anybody who knew him, his family, his kids, people who worked with him. I mean, Harry was, he really truly believed that the Warner Brothers studio and movies in general could be a source for good and equality, and it could bring people together and build bridges. And
this Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And that was something he, you know, that's why you have, like, right, the Warner Brothers slogans of, you know, to educate and entertain. He used a lot and that kind of thing. I mean, he really, really believed that movies could be a source of good in a world where so many things were falling apart.
Yeah, that's almost like, one of the reef ideas of the BBC, you know, that we're not just here to push stuff out. We're here to educate people. And
so, absolutely.
Some of those battles that are coming up, they're on the right side when it comes to the war and earlier than many other people, as you say, Black Legion is clearly about a sign of that. But then as you get into sort of murkier waters of the 50s, you get the blacklists and you get something which I think is an interesting thing. I was reading your book as we're undergoing a writer's strike and now an actor's strike. And it was interesting to sort of put these two parts together as well. So, I mean, let's do the blacklist, but maybe we can go on the white writer strike as well quite quickly, because the blacklist, I feel a lot of people already know about. But what was the Warner Brothers sort of, they had a little bit of a contradictory stance, didn't they? Because they were like, nobody should lose their living because of their political beliefs, and then we're going to have a blacklist.
Yeah, it's tricky. And this is where, like, one of the things that I found that really opened my eyes was, right, you know, so again, Harry Warner defends the industry in his studio in 1941. And he actually told Jack not to waste his time with HUAC because he saw how phony these government officials were. And it was no different then as it was in 47. Even Ronald Reagan admits this in his memoir that the House going after Hollywood was they were looking for headlines, right? They were looking for publicity, that if we, you know, you know, look, you know, Humphrey Bogart's flying in, right? Like we that's going to get headlines,
right?
And Lauren Bacall and Danny Kaye and everybody coming in, the Committee for the First Amendment. So they're contradictory in the sense that they, you know, they want to support their workers. And what I learned and what really I think helped me see going back through all the blacklist stuff again, because like you said, this is a horse that's been beaten dead for so long. Mm. But I don't know if you read Tom Doherty's show trial.
No, I haven't. No,
he would be a good person to have on here too. I think you'd love talking to him. He did a really good job trying to parse through the politics of the 30s and how it bled into the 40s, and how a lot of the studio bosses truly didn't care about the politics of their employees, but what they feared by 1947 was the political winds of the country, right? Mm. So if they look soft on communism, people are going to stop going to movies. And if people stop going to movies, now we're all out of work. So he makes a really good case for showing that these moguls maybe were not as ideological with this as previous generations might have thought. You know, of course, you know, this is the kind of thing that's so contentious that, you know, decades almost have to go by before we can, you know, see it clearly. And also maybe Dalton Trumbo was right. Maybe this was only victims, right? Like it was just a bad time. And I get that sense from Jack too. When you listen to his testimony and even read the closed door testimony he did before the public one, he seems scared as hell. Like he doesn't seem, I mean, and this whole like pest removal fund that my brothers will fund, I mean, that sounds so constructed and desperate. And even Walt Disney, right? You listen to his and he's sitting there like he doesn't seem like, oh, like I, you know, I want to dedicate my life to getting the commies. They seem frustrated. And, you know, not that I agree with what they did, but it's, yeah, again, just trying to look at it as this entire industry put in a really tough spot because the U.S. government is going against them, and the entire political winds of the country are hinging seemingly on what Hollywood does right here and now, which is a terrifying spot to be in. Mm. I couldn't imagine what it would have been like to try to be saddled with that. And that's why it's just unfortunate that Harry was, you know, he was old. He kind of had one foot out the door by the late 40s. And I think if he would have been subpoenaed, it might have been a little bit different, because I don't, because he had embarrassed the senators. So I think he wouldn't have been afraid of Thomas and Nixon in 47.
Right.
But it's a weird time. And long story short, I could babble on forever about this, but I feel like we can see it a little bit more nuanced today, where we don't have to endorse HUAC, but we can see that the studios were in a really, really difficult spot.
Right. Right. And the pressures, I mean, you can kind of see it as well today in the sense of like the pressures of feeling like you're about to be canceled and your whole career is going to go down the tubes. That, okay, you don't want to give a, you know, you don't want to say to anyone, look, it's a little bit more nuanced than just outright condemnation or outright support. But the minute you nuance enters the argument, you've kind of lost. You know, that's going to be, you're going to be beaten to death by both sides. So moving on to the strike and something which is very relevant today. I mean, I push back on the Hitler versus Hollywood book. So you know that I'll always push back a little bit on your books out of love.
always.
I know the sort of gangster background of the union and the infiltration of the unions and that violence was horrific. And that's, there's nothing. But I kind of wanted to know a little bit more about why were the strikes? I mean, these people obviously were feeling like the work practices where they were working weren't, you know, they were seeing the studio bosses living off the fat of the land, and they felt they were contributing to that and they weren't getting a fair shake. So I just felt there was a little, it just felt like this is the unions against the Warners, rather than, well, they could have also treated the workers a little bit better and maybe avoided some of this.
Oh, you're exactly right. No, and that's something I should have added another layer to, because when I was looking through this, I was seeing it more as like the mob against Warners. Because right at this time, IATSE was, you know, you had Bioff and Brown, and you had, you know, these mobsters that were literally murdering rival union members and stuff like that.
So which is horrible as well. I mean, that's another thing.
So that's kind of where my head was at when I was writing a lot of this part, where it was I'm looking at it as kind of a mob versus the studio thing. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the reasons for the strikes and the reasons they got so ugly, some of it was mob influence, but also some of it, I mean, this is right when you're talking, you know, 30s and 40s Hollywood, working at these studios, even for the stars, was not glamorous, right? These were, you know, when we think of, you know, dream factories, the key word here is factory. Like these were very, like the day to day was very, you know, the hour to hour experience during a day was very blue collar. I mean, it was tough. It was hot. The days were long, 6 days a week. Everybody had really good reason to push back. I mean, the contracts were oppressive. And I guess there's been so much written about that. I guess I felt like I didn't need to, you know, go back into that. But no, you're completely right, and I agree with you that there's, you know, there were layers of this uprising that maybe I just felt go without saying, but shouldn't go without saying, because we should remember this, that yeah, these were not always great places to work. And even for a lot of the celebrities, it was, you know, but then if you think, if it's tough for Betty Davis, it's got to be really tough for that assistant director, right? Or the script girl, or, you know, all the below the line labor that often gets forgotten, even in today's strikes, right? That gets, you know, I just spent 10 days in LA doing research and some book talks, and I have friends that are writers and producers, and they're all just, they said that the attrition in Hollywood right now is, it's like 10-20% people that just had to like go home because they, you know, they can't afford to live in Los Angeles for however many months with no pay. So you're just, you're losing big chunks of the industry as well. And it's always going to be the very bottom that suffers the worst. So that's a really unfortunate part. And then restaurants that aren't going out of business and stuff, well, right?
What's the temperature? What's the temperature there, metaphorically? What's the, you know, how do you feel? Is it going to go on and on, or what's the?
Well, there was just the news that you know, there, everyone's, you know, the WGA and the studios are coming back to the table. But I mean, that you can, the tension, you can feel it out there for sure. I mean, I was driving, you know, from Burbank to the Herrick Library multiple days, and, you know, driving past Disney and driving past Warner Brothers, there's people out there every day picketing. And one of my friends had said, you know, I didn't see as many people at Universal when I drove by, and I was told, I must have missed this if it was covered in the trades, but I was told that what you're not supposed to do out there in the summer is trim the trees over the sidewalks, because it's the hottest part of the year and it's gonna, you know, it's bad for the trees. Warner or Universal cut back all the foliage so the sidewalks would be hot as hell for people picketing. I mean, so it got ugly really early on. So I mean, that's I'm sure was part of the same time when, I mean, I don't know if it was Iger, whoever came out and said, oh, we'll just wait until people start losing their homes. It's everyone is mad. I had dinner with a friend of a friend who's a captain in the WGA, and he's, I mean, you just mention it and he starts getting hot,
right.
You know, so it's it is very, when people talk about existential crisis in the press, when you go out there and you sit down at a restaurant, you could feel it.
Yeah. Who knew that, you know, putting your industry in the hands of a bunch of venture capitalists was a bad idea?
Right. Well, and that's one thing that has come up in recent weeks talking about this book, is like, what was the difference between, you know, the Warners or the studios then? You know, it's like, on some, or what would they do now is a question that always comes up. And it's like, well, I'm sure, you know, they push back on all the unions, all the stuff, you know, they wanted complete control. So they would be doing some of the similar stuff of the guys today, I have no doubt. But the big difference, though, is that the Warners, you know, like a lot of these other studio founder industry founders, they were movie people. You know, they loved movies, right? Harry, right, just believed in the role of movies in the global society. I don't get that sense from these, you know, the venture capitalists today, right? I don't think I don't know if Jeff Bezos has really thought about the power of movies, right? Yeah. So even though he bought Jack Warner's estate, right? But I don't know if he actually, but these people, you know, for, like I said, we can talk about the ways they treated labor, but they truly believed in their product in a way that I'm not seeing currently.
No, absolutely not. I was reading the other day that Netflix always cancel their shows after two seasons because the third season, everybody gets pay bumps and everybody gets, sick pay and vacation pay and all this sort of stuff. So they cancel this and then they restart the same, the same type of thing, but with a vaguely different name. And it's just
sure. And the version of that the studios would do, including Warner Brothers, like in the 30s and 40s, if they had a star that was on the rise and was coming to the end of a contract and this person knows that, all right, well, I'm worth more now, they would say, hey, we're going to extend your contract for 7 years right now for the same pay.
Yeah.
Right. And then try to lock you into that before, you know, now that you're famous, right? And that was what was you know, a big part of a lot of the debates between, you know, the studio and, you know, Olivia de Havilland and Betty Davis and Cagney, the ones that pushed back the hardest. So that was the studio era version of exactly what Netflix was doing, right?
I'd always have, I like the point you make in your book of always have like a slightly younger guy coming up as well, or slightly younger girl coming up as well, so that the Tab Hunter sort of role, he could, when James Dean dies, he's suddenly there and he's ready to step into all those roles.
Right. Well, and like Warner Brothers, one of my favorite Warner Brothers films from the 50s, A Face in the Crowd, it's the same thing, right? When Andy Griffith's character, you know, falls, you know, Walter Matthau gives that good lecture at the end, like, hey, there's always going to be another one here, you know, younger, and everyone's going to forget about you. And yeah, there was a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny as you get older as well. You get less angry at things. I used to get angry at, you know, music groups that I thought were particularly asinine, and it's like, oh, there'll be at least three this decade. There's no point, you know. Right. I'll see their birth, their rise, and their death within the decade. You know, I don't need to worry about it. So let's get to the final sort of tragedy of the book, really, which is the breakup of the family with Jack's betrayal of Harry in the it's Shakespearean.
It is.
Give us the gruesome details on this one.
So this really is. I mean, I kept going back and forth on what to call this, you know, the chapter subtitle in here. And I while I was writing it, I just wrote The Betrayal because that's what Cass Warner put in her book.
Yeah.
And I couldn't come up with a different way. That's what it is. It is that. And it's interesting because in recent months, I've been put in touch with Jack Warner's grandson, Greg Orr. And he pushes back on this a little bit because, I mean, he doesn't really defend Jack. I mean, he's a warts and all on Jack. But he does make the point that, you know, I'm getting ahead of this a little bit, but, you know, Jack would have been in the trades that Jack might have stayed running the studio. But basically what happens is, right, going back to the influence of the parents, this all for one, one for all, Harry and Albert and Jack start to, and of course, Harry and Albert are a lot older and they want to retire. And they're like, why don't we sell our stock and we do it all together, just like mom and dad said we should. You know, we stayed together. We built this together. We go out together and it'll be the best ode to our parents. And they all agree and they sell their shares. And what happens is what Jack does is he takes a backdoor deal to buy his shares back, but not only to buy his shares back, but to take Harry's job as studio president. So this is, you know, and again, Greg Orr, you know, this was Serge Simonenko was the finance guru from out east that was shepherding this whole purchase. And it was in the trades that they're going to need, unlike today, they're going to need, we need a Hollywood insider to run the studio.
Right.
And so Jack's name had been floated. But what was different here was it wasn't that he was just running the studio, is that he got, you know, he bought back into the company and then took Harry's job. And when Harry heard this, he had a heart attack from which he never fully recovered. He died 2 years later, but he had a heart attack hearing this. And that tells you how grave this truly betrayal was. I mean, I think Harry, you know, Greg, or he makes a good point that, well, Harry should have seen this coming. On one level, maybe, but I think Harry was so, he believed so much in his family that he thought that Jack would do a lot of things. Jack's going to run around on his wife. Jack's going to treat the rest of the family like garbage, but he's not going to do this. I really thought that he thought this would be a bridge too far, even for Jack. And I think that's why it hit him so hard. And yeah, it's heartbreaking to read. I mean, you know, even just going through all this and the interviews and the press and everybody's stories and writing this, you know, I almost felt like my own little bit of PTSD just going through it. Like, wow,
you broke my heart, Fredo. You broke my heart.
Absolutely. It absolutely was that. It was like, man, this sucks. This was so awful.
I mean, it's King Lear, isn't it? I mean, it's like, you know, I'm going to divide my kingdom and I'm going to go and retire. And then it's like, oh, no, we'll accept it, but actually we're going to do this in the background.
Absolutely. And what's interesting about this too, I mean, going back to like really needing movie people on the studio. I mean, so Jack became the president of Warner Brothers, but he didn't move to New York to then, you know, reign over the entire operation like Harry did. He stayed in LA as the studio president and still oversaw movie production and was watching dailies and weighing in on edits and greenlighting movies and all this and dealing with the censors, all of this stuff as studio president. So yeah. It's absolutely wild.
There's another question I wanted to ask, which is, the Warner Brothers as a studio in some ways sort of epitomize how we culturally look at studios now. I'm thinking of like, you can't help but watch Barton Fink and see the studio head wearing a World War, you know, a uniform and the lawyer played by Tony Shalhoub, who I think he has the same name or is even based on the real life lawyer who got Errol Flynn off his rape charges.
Oh, Jerry Giesler. Yeah. Yeah.
Geisler.
Yeah. Yep.
He's always, people are going, there's phone call for you, Mr. Giesler. Geisler.
Yep. Yeah. Geisler. Right. And that's what's so great about, this is the kind of stuff that is justifiably we should poke Jack about, right? Like he's, you know, all these studio heads have some kind of service to the war through the Office of War Information. But, you know, they're not fighting overseas, right? But they still come back and they wear their uniforms and like everyone had to call Jack Warner Colonel Warner and all this kind of stuff. And it's laughable and it just shows a kind of arrogance that is just kind of funny. It's like, you know, it's like when you there was a service to the war. Absolutely. But at the same time, you know, there were actual movie stars that went, you know, like Jimmy Stewart wasn't doing that. He was a fighter pilot, right? He wasn't going around telling everyone to address him by his military rank, you know, and all this kind of stuff, you know, his service rank.
Lee Marvin was a sniper,
right? You know,
and he got dishonorably discharged despite the fact that he was in combat and was wounded a whole number of times, you know.
Right.
But even presidents sort of had something to do with the war. You don't see them parading around in uniform, hopefully. Well, actually, no, George W. Bush.
He
was roundly criticized for that. He was sort of like, no, the president shouldn't be wearing a combat jacket. It's not his. That's beneath the, you know, that's not how it should be.
Yeah. When you're sitting as the president, right? Like you need to.
Exactly. Separation.
Observe your rank, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 That's amazing. I really enjoyed the book. I was so looking forward to talking to you about it, Chris, because I think as well, I loved your earlier book, but I really did want to see this broader picture, which are, you know, this broader canvas, which you're able to operate on. I am going to ask you for another recommended book. So you get an opportunity to recommend another book.
Oh, recommending a book.
This is always the hardest question, right?
It is. There are so many. And I'm just trying to think of what I'm just actually going back through. I mean, I rewatched Chinatown the other night, and I'm rereading Sam's book on The Big Goodbye. And it's like, I remember it being awesome, but it's like, wow, this is even better than I remembered reading it 3 years ago.
Don't you hate him?
Oh, it's so good.
A little bit.
And he's got a new one coming out on Coppola.
in November, I think.
In a couple of months. And yeah. I'm also reading, well, and another one, I mean, so that book, a lot of your listeners have probably read that. So one that you haven't read that I'm reading for a review is Scott Eiman's book on Chaplin. It's called Charlie Chaplin versus America. So it's a really interesting snap. I mean, he chronicles all Chaplin's entire life, but really focuses on how Chaplin was treated as the kind of social and cultural winds of the United States shifted, and how he was kind of railroaded by a lot of people. And the goal of his, he says from the beginning of the book, this book is, you know, Chaplin was canceled in the 40s and he's going to try to save him. Mm. So that's coming out in like a month or so. So I finished that a couple of days ago. So I would recommend that. That's an upcoming book. Excellent. That I can recommend.
Excellent. Oh, I'd love to get Scott on the show, actually, because I've read his book on John Wayne, and John Wayne is one of those characters who, I don't know, you sort of always have there as a kind of movie icon.
Yep.
And then you read Scott's book and you go back and you rewatch those movies and you think, oh my God, this guy's actually, he's a really good actor. I can really see what he does, and I can appreciate
and
him in any way.
There's parallels between that book and the Chaplin one in that these are two figures where there's so much mythology built up around them, and a lot of it is garbage.
Right.
So he's trying to cut through that. He does this really well in his John Wayne book too, because right, I mean, so much of John Wayne is interpreted today through that like unfortunate Playboy interview he gave.
Mm.
But so much of his life contradicts everything he said in that interview. And it's very similar with Chaplin, where there was a lot of FBI investigation and a lot of accusations and a lot of stuff. And as you know, there are certain things about Chaplin that's cringy. It's like, yeah, here was this 50-year-old guy who liked 18-year-old girls. And it's like, that's still weird, right? Maybe not illegal, but still definitely weird and cringy. Mm. But there was a lot of political stuff that he does a really good job parsing through that, I think it brings to life some of his later movies. And what I learned through that book is why I actually really like King of New York and some of these later movies, because I feel like we're getting the real Chaplin in a really interesting way. And Scott's book is a great asset to helping us, you know, bring a lot more to those later movies, right? It's easy to love Great Dictator and Modern Times and City Lights and, you know, The Kid and all these, but it's not as easy to love those later films. And I think that book gives us the tools to really dive into those in a meaningful way.
Yeah. I'm talking about Dana Stevens earlier, before we were taping, there's the idea of Limelight as well, and how he sort of cuts the scenes that he does with Keaton. It's there could be more of that, and he cuts it out because maybe he doesn't want to be compared to Keaton. And that's such an interesting chapter.
Right. That there's some stories in Eiman's new book about that, about, you know, people, you know, fanning over Keaton and Chaplin getting really sad.
Yeah.
You know, thinking like, but I'm Chaplin.
Yeah, but I'm here. I mean, jeepers creepers. I mean, there's you and there's Keaton, and then there's a long way down before you hit Harold Lloyd. I mean,
for sure. Yeah. No argument there. Absolutely. Absolutely. There's
Keaton and Chaplin it's a little bit like my favorite Stanley Kubrick film. It's whichever one I'm watching, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Those two are really in a league of their own.
Yeah.
And you can, then we talked about this transition from silent to sound, right? I mean, when you look at Chaplin and Keaton, you can see why they, you know, didn't make as many sound movies, and, you know, why their careers were different. Cause it's like, they were truly the peak of the medium as it was silent, and it still has an impact. You know, I know a couple comedy writers, and one comedy writer in LA who has worked on some big shows. I mean, he's told me a lot of people he knows out there still study silent comedy to inform their, you know, current writing. I mean, the cadence and everything. I mean, that you can still learn from that, right? When you're adding words, I mean, just the way they understood, you know, the beats and when, you know, when to take the fall or when to make the face or when to do nothing. It's incredible
how long between a setup and a callback you can stretch it, you know? And absolutely. That you watch Sherlock Jr. And I think that film has everything you need to know about film comedy in there, you know?
I'm glad you mentioned that. I was just going to mention that film, cause I use in my intro class, I, in my intro to film class, I show that to students who've never seen, most of them have never seen a black and white movie, let alone a silent movie. And it's a great one because that's like 45 minutes long and it's, yeah, you know, it's not a big commitment, but they warm up to it real fast and start laughing at it like it's a brand new comedy,
yeah,
made today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible that it's almost, what was that, 24? So almost 100 years, you know, it, you know, and it's here. It still has that impact. It's incredible.
Right. It's on my top 10. It's on my top 10, absolutely. Well, listen, Chris, it's been wonderful talking to you as ever. And I hope everyone will read Warner Brothers. It's already out, right? It's already...
Yeah, it came out on the 5th of September. Yep.
Excellent. Okay, so everybody can order it straight away. Thanks, Chris. It's been great talking.
Always a blast. Thank you.
That was me and Chris talking about Warner Brothers and issues they're relating. He recommended two film books. He recommended Sam Wasson's book on Chinatown, The Big Goodbye, as well as looking forward to his new book on Zoetrope Studios and the Coppolas, which hopefully Sam is going to come on. Book is due for release in November, so hopefully he'll come on sometime around then to talk about it. And he's also anticipated a book on Charlie Chaplin by Scott Eyman, a great biographer of John Wayne and John Ford, and a writer who I have hoped to get on the podcast for some time. And I'm happy to say I think he's going to come on and talk about Charlie Chaplin. So we've got that to look forward to in the future. Next week, Ian Nathan is going to be on the podcast talking about his new book about Clint Eastwood. So that's all to look forward to. But until then, listener, please take care.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.